Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Before we get to our next guest, Ruchir Sharma, just a quick update on the fiscal cliff negotiations, which, of course, we're following every day here. It's now down to Boehner and Obama. They basically kicked everybody else out of the room, and they're doing one-on-one negotiations to try to solve this thing. And Speaker Boehner made a statement just a little while ago. Here is about 1 minute's worth.
Listen, Washington's got a spending problem, not a revenue problem. If the president doesn't agree with our proposal, I believe that he's got an obligation to families and small businesses to offer a plan of his own, a plan that can pass both chambers of the Congress. We're ready and eager to talk to the president about such a plan.
Speaker, you did speak with the president earlier this week. Can you characterize that call? I mean, if he called, did he have any kind of counteroffer? And also, we understand that he just is making clear that it's got to be increase in rates for the wealthy or no deal. Are you willing to give a little bit, maybe just not all the way to 39.6?
It was the phone call was pleasant, but was just more of the same. Even the conversations that the staff had yesterday, just more of the same. It's time for the president, if he's serious, to come back to us with a counteroffer.
Well, he didn't say no to the reporter's question, so it probably reinforces the growing conventional wisdom that there is going to be some partial give on those Bush tax hike rates or tax cut rates, and the president is going to give more on spending, and they will figure it out somehow. But there's the latest statement just a short time ago from House Speaker John Boehner. Now, kind of one-on-one. Of course, each of those ones has a huge team behind them, but there aren't the Senate leaders in the room. Nancy Pelosi isn't in the room. It's now Boehner and Obama and their teams trying to avoid the fiscal cliff. My next guest is Ruchir Sharma, head of emerging markets at Morgan Stanley. He manages about $25 billion in emerging markets investments, and he has a new book called Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles. Ruchir, thanks very much for coming on. Welcome to WNYC.
Great to see you here.
So, as you know, and a lot of the listeners know, I spent last week on a tour for journalists in China.
Right.
And on yesterday's show, we heard from Chinese venture capitalist and pro-authoritarian Eric Li, who said China's one-party state is better for economic growth than America's democracy, with our tendency toward fiscal cliffs and gridlock and things like that. Here's a little bit of Li that we didn't use yesterday on this idea from the Aspen Ideas Festival.
The ideas of democracy had contributed a great deal to the rise of the West as the world's dominant power, but it is now in big trouble in both America and Europe. Electoral politics is in disarray on both sides of the Atlantic. It's captive of money and special interests. Political system is completely incapable. The electoral democratic system in the West and the developing countries are completely incapable. Proven itself so far, you could still fix it, but so far incapable of dealing with the monumental challenges and distress that they're experiencing right now.
Eric Li, knocking democracy is not up to the challenge of our times. But Ruchir Sharma, I see in the book that you argue that political systems aren't even all that relevant to growth either way, in your opinion. How far do you go with that?
You know, like, I've done so much research on this topic because I know that this it's popular these days to sort of admire what's happening in China and all the dysfunctional politics out here in the U.S. And here's the conclusion that, you know, there have been about 120 high growth cases over the last three decades. And I define high growth as countries that have been able to grow at 5% or more on an average annual basis in any particular decade. Half of those were democracies. Half of those were authoritarian regimes. Huh. So the entire point is that it's not the system which matters. That for every China that succeeds as an authoritarian state, I can point out to you some country somewhere in the world that has not succeeded trying to follow the Chinese model. In Asia itself, you take the case of Vietnam, that so many people sort of thought that Vietnam is the next China just because it had similar traits to China. And that economy has been in a horrible mess over the last 5 years or so. Then, of course, there are so many dictatorships across the world, in Africa, Zimbabwe, you know, wherever you start, which have done very poorly. So the entire point here is it's not the political system which matters. It's the quality of leadership at the top. And you can find those in both democracies and also in authoritarian regimes.
It's kind of depressing in a way, though, for an American. I mean, it would be nice to believe that freedom leads to more economic success, which is what I think people used to believe about the United States in the 20th century. But you don't buy it.
No, in terms of my point is like it does not matter one way or the other. So you had this huge East Asian economic miracle which took place in so many countries from Korea, Taiwan, and those countries started off by being sort of authoritarian or dictatorships and then evolved to becoming democracies. So I think what is true if you look at long-term history is that as countries get richer, they tend to get more democratic. But in the first phase of growth, at least until they reach middle-income status, it does not matter whether you're authoritarian or democratic. For economic growth, if economic growth is your only goal.
It matters if it's well managed as economic growth.
Yeah.
And you write about the last 33 years of spectacular economic growth in China as what you call the Deng Dynasty, Deng Xiaoping.
Mm-hmm.
Using that word dynasty, that refers really usually to Chinese eras from past centuries. Why the Deng Dynasty?
No, because I think that his blessings were very important in the succession plans that followed after that. They were in some way or the other, the leadership in China since Deng in the late 70s has been touched by his influence. So therefore, I refer to it in a sort of congratulatory way about the way the succession has been managed in China over all these years. So I have a lot of admiration as far as China is concerned, but I think it's a complete myth to believe that you have to grow and you have to be authoritarian only to try and achieve high growth rates.
You also note that after decades of these market reforms that allowed more inequality in China in pursuit of more growth, the government is now reversing course and emphasizing minimum wage increases rather than growth and productivity. So we're now seeing 15 to 20% wage increases in China in recent years, despite some of the reputation of, you know, the slave wage factory labor. Is that because people finally wouldn't take it anymore in terms of dollar a day, $2 a day manufacturing?
You know, like I think the big story in China is that it's no longer a poor country. It is now a middle-income country. Yes, there are poor people in China, but it is, on average, a middle-income country. And as you get to middle-income, the bargaining power of labor increases and the labor surplus also begins to dwindle. So now you have to deal with labor shortages. So the bargaining power is moving back to labor after being in favor of capital all these years. So I think that's the transition that China is going through. But here, to me, is the really big story, which is that as I travel the world, what I find fascinating today is that the problems that America is facing and the debate that we are having here in America, the same kind of debates are raging in China, in India, in South Korea, in Chile. And those debates have to do with inequality, cronyism, too many people at the top benefiting disproportionately. And in China, when you were there, you would have probably noticed that the leadership there is very wide-eyed about these problems. They are increasingly focused on corruption as a huge issue out there and in terms of constraining the wealth at the top. So I think that these issues are very much there in China too.
I'm glad you brought that up because I was going to, and I think one of the biggest things that I learned in China is that people there have some of the same economic concerns as people here.
Yeah.
Very specifically, wage stagnation, making it hard to afford a home, which was listed to us as the number one issue by a Chinese pollster that we met with. And like us, they now have an aging population with slower growth and rising government expenses that would suggest. How far do the parallels go?
Well, I think the parallels are much further than we think. The other problem that China has is of debt. That China's total debt as a share of its economy is quite high.
Debt, really?
Yeah.
I thought they're a country with a big surplus and they're buying our debt.
Yeah, that's true in terms of, but they also have a huge amount of domestic debt, especially on the corporate balance sheets and also the local government level. So they have a fair amount of debt as a share of their economy, and I think that is less well understood.
And some of that is leveraged real estate debt, and some people say they may face, if not to the same extent, the similar kind of housing bubble collapse that we have gone through in recent years.
Well, they're very concerned about the housing prices out there, and they've done a lot over the last 3 years to try and restrain the increase in home prices, because the affordability of homes for the average Chinese is quite out of reach. So I think that's a major issue in China today, that they want to make homes more affordable, but the prices, given their income, is really high, about 10 times higher than their average income level.
So the tour I was on was sponsored by the Chinese-American group, the Committee of 100, which has this laudable aim of cooperation rather than confrontation between our two countries, the U.S. and China. And by the way, I saw in your book that something else that I had learned, which is that China has about the same area as the United States. And I think Americans, maybe because they have 1.3 billion people, or just the way we look at the globe when we're kids, we think of China as this huge thing, like Russia, which really is a huge thing.
Country, yeah.
But China only has about the same area as the United States, but they have four times as many people.
I'll tell you about one more startling statistic, and I quote that in the book as well, that Gallup carried out a poll of Americans asking that which is the world's largest economy. And you'd be shocked. More than half of Americans said the world's largest economy is China.
It's still us. But people don't know what that means. What does world's largest economy actually mean?
In terms of the size of the economy. So the American economy is about $15 trillion in size. The Chinese economy is $7 trillion in size. But such is the perception about China sort of winning and being so dominant, that a lot of Americans have psyched themselves into thinking that China has already won this economic race.
But it's still taking jobs from the United States in this certain sense, right? Like back in the 90s, labor in this country complained when President Clinton signed the NAFTA agreement because manufacturing jobs fled to low-wage Mexico. Then Mexico complained when those jobs fled to even lower-wage China. Now China is beginning to develop wage standards. And guess what? Manufacturing jobs are fleeing to countries like Bangladesh, where that death trap of a garment factory killed 112 workers in a horrific fire last month. The Times today says the workers were mostly rural women making $45 a month. Mm-hmm. So I don't know where we ever hit bottom on this.
Yeah, but I think that's just the way the process of economic development works, that as you get richer, the poorer jobs, so to speak, move to countries that are poorer. So what you're seeing is that China now is clearing the space out for some of the low-end goods that it was making, including like textiles and toys. And those jobs are moving to other places in Asia with a lower per capita income than China. That's just a natural process of economic development. And as we saw, like in America, that America has a major unemployment problem, but it's much better than what's happening in Europe. And I don't hear such complaints in Europe so much about China taking all their jobs away. But it's probably more true of Europe than it is true in America.
Why wouldn't they complain as much about it?
Because I think that they, you know, sort of understand that this problem dates back to the rise of China. If you look at the unemployment problem in Europe, it's not, you know, something which has to do just with the rise of China. It's been much more structural in nature. It's got to do with the nature of their labor markets, the rigidities involved out there. So I think, you know, we also here in America need to look at those factors rather than be so focused on the fact that someone else is eating our lunch.
And I think that Europe, in the social democracies that dominate there, is just more comfortable with unemployment in general. People living on the benefits that they get and can get longer term, and I think they're a little higher. If they are unemployed, they just have a different relationship with unemployment in countries like France, don't they?
Yes, they do. But I think that even there, they're getting quite fed up now, you know, given the amount of unemployment they have in places such as Greece and Spain. And these countries now are carrying out labor market reform to try and make the labor markets more flexible. The model in Europe, which people are speaking about increasingly, is the country of Ireland, which has a much more flexible labor market, a more competitive landscape, and is done reasonably okay in recovering from the recession after suffering a very serious downturn. So I think that they understand that some of the problems there have to do with the nature of the labor market and it being far too sort of cushy, and they need to make some changes to that.
My guest is Ruchir Sharma, emerging markets manager at Morgan Stanley and author of the new book, Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracle. I just want to finish the point and the question I was starting on, referring to the goal of the tour from C100 aimed at cooperation rather than confrontation. Do you think there are policies that both countries, the U.S. and China, could pursue to the benefit of both nations' growth and wage-earning classes? Because we so often hear about it as a zero-sum game.
Well, I don't think it's a zero-sum game because China has been doing well now for 3 decades. And it's only because of the problems in America over the last 5-7 years that this thing has seemed like a zero-sum game. In the 1990s, when China was doing very well and the U.S. had an unemployment rate of 4-5%, you didn't hear much about China. So I think it's more because of the problems that we have had at home that we get to hear about these tensions and the end of a peaceful coexistence between these two countries. But as the 1990s showed us, it's perfectly legitimate to accept that you'll have peaceful coexistence between these two countries.
And there was the 1980s, where at least for 10 minutes, we thought that Japan was the country that was going to eat our lunch.
You know, that's like, I think, always been America's both strength and weakness, this paranoia that someone outside is going to do better than us and take over from us. So I think that we saw, even with regard to Japan, as you point out, my mind goes back to the 1992 presidential campaign out here. It was all about Japan and how Japan's a currency manipulator and how the yen is really sort of, undervalued and how Japan is buying all real estate out here and what should we do about that.
And boy, doesn't all that sound familiar.
Exactly. So I think, that's something which is a continuous pattern as far as the U.S. is concerned. And in the 1970s, it was all about the Soviet Union, when the CIA and all were projecting how the Soviet Union was going to overtake America as the world's largest economy. So I think that these projections we all have to take with a pinch of salt. But the good thing here is that this paranoia also focuses the American mind on remaining quite competitive. Like the big change which is happening now is what's happening on the energy front. The revolution that's happening on the shale gas front is really remarkable and how it's going to make the U.S. an energy exporter later this decade. And China, on the other hand, will remain a very large energy importer and is constantly worried about its energy supplies. So I think that these changes take place here, but good technology is what's helped America now on a path towards becoming an energy exporter.
I think here in New York, we sometimes miss the largeness of the shale story. And let me get your take on that, because here we have the whole debate about whether Governor Cuomo is going to extend the moratorium on fracking. It's such a big political issue here. But when T. Boone Pickens, Mr. Fracking, was on the show, he said, go ahead and do whatever you do in New York. I don't really care. It's such small potatoes in terms of the fracking and shale industry in the United States. So New York politics aside, even right or wrong aside, how transformative do you think that the whole shale gas and oil exploration is going to be with respect to the U.S. economy? I know some business experts who say it's going to absolutely change everything.
I agree with that view. And now to say it changes everything maybe too much, but it's going to be a significant mover. For the U.S. to become energy independent completely, already its energy dependence on foreign imports is declining. Over the last 5 years, it's already fallen by about 10 percentage points or so. And that process now seems to be irreversible. So I think this is a huge positive. And along with a bunch of other factors, it really provides new hope for the American economy. The other factor I find very good for the U.S. is how cheap the exchange rate now is. Our work shows that the dollar today is one of the cheapest currencies in the world. It's super competitive. So I get colleagues of mine who come visiting to New York from emerging markets, and the afternoon, on a Friday afternoon, they've disappeared because they're too busy shopping.
Yes.
So it just is sort of, so I think these factors of having very good tech industry, that the U.S. remains at the forefront of the tech revolution in the world. It spends the most of any country on R&D, what's happening on the energy front, the exchange rate. These are all positive factors, which to me, in fact, make it look that in the coming decade, America could be a breakout nation as well.
A weak dollar may be good for tourists visiting the United States and those stores that are selling them goods. But we are a trade deficit nation. We import more than we export. Mm-hmm. So isn't a weak dollar bad for the country in general?
Yeah, but it's changing because of that. So like the U.S. exports are picking up. Their share in the global economy over the last 2 to 3 years has been continuously picking up. The trade account is showing some signs of turning around. And, you know, so I think that this is the mirror image of a decade ago. A decade ago, the exchange rate was very expensive. Today, the exchange rate is very cheap, and I think that sets the stage for a turnaround in the U.S. trade deficit.
We'll continue in a minute with Ruchir Sharma from Morgan Stanley, Director of Emerging Markets there, and author now of Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next next Economic Miracles. And we'll talk about some of those possible next economic miracles, including Turkey, which is a very interesting example in your book. So stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Ruchir Sharma, author of Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles. And the premise of your book is partly that all four of what we call the BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, China, India, or the BRICS, if you include South Africa, are not destined to keep rising and compete with the United States more and more, as we have thought. We talked about it in the case of China. But why do you think we put the BRICS in general on too much of a pedestal?
Well, I think that last decade what happened was that every single emerging market boomed. This acronym BRICS got particularly popular because it captured the largest emerging markets. And this unprecedented boom in emerging markets made us look that all these countries were destined to catch up with the U.S. It was only a matter of time before they'd become as rich as the U.S. or their economic size would become the same as the U.S. These fancy projections that by 2030 this would happen, 2050 that would happen. And I think that the problem here is that we all sort of kind of overlooked as to what caused this boom in all these emerging markets. It was a whole amount of global liquidity sloshing around the system, which went into these markets, and it led to an artificial boom in some of these countries. And that bloom is now coming off the rose. So now I think what's happening is that the focus is turning back into the fact that these countries also have their domestic problems. So take the case of Brazil. Their growth rate this year is down to 1%. Now that's, hardly something, you know, which makes it a very special economy out there. Russia's growth rate is down to 3.5%. And India's economy is, you know, still growing at 5.5%, but this is down from 9%. That was the pace for the 5 years ago or so. So all these countries are stumbling upon their own domestic problems. And my case is not that all these countries are bound to sputter, but the fact that you cannot sort of treat them in this sort of really optimistic way and think that all these economies, all because their emerging economies are bound to rise and converge with the developed world. That just does not happen. That's not the history of economic development. There are 180 economies in the world. Only 35 are developed. Everyone else is emerging. And that's been the case for a very long period of time.
Aren't they going to emerge? Talking like none of them are actually going to be in a state that you would call emerged.
No, I think that they will. But I think that this game is, as I put it in the book, it's like a game of chutes and ladders, which is that some countries get lucky. They find the right formula. They get to the top. But often they get bitten by a snake on the way and they fall back down. So the entire point here is that, yes, there will be winners, but there'll also be losers. And the important thing which I focus on in the book is that we need to sort out as to which will be the winners and which will be the losers. And that's really important rather than believing that each one will emerge.
One of the countries that you devote a whole chapter to is Turkey, not usually Americans' first thought with response to economic growth. What's happening in Turkey?
Well, I think that the whole point, very good economic leadership, under a largely democratic setup. And over the last decade, that country has brought inflation under control. It's been one of the most reformist countries in the world in terms of the kind of economic reforms that they've carried out. And their economic growth rate is quite high. and they've integrated themselves very well with other countries in the region. So the exports to places such as Kazakhstan and other places in the region are doing very well. So Turkey has sort of changed its obsession from a decade ago, where all it wanted to be was a part of Europe in some way or the other, to now becoming a regional powerhouse and a very important model for the Arab world too, that, you know, this sort of notion exists, this cultural myth that all because you're a Muslim country, you are unlikely to be able to achieve economic success. But I think what Turkey is doing is showing to the world that it can be an economic role model. And if you look at the policymakers in Egypt today, you know, when you speak to them in private, they often use the example of Turkey as being a role model.
What's their economy based on in Turkey primarily?
Well, their economy is based on services. They also have a manufacturing sector as well, but it's a services-led economy. They have banking, finance, tourism. So it's a services-based economy, but also manufacturing. And construction is a very big deal out there in terms of that you have some major construction companies that are helping rebuild the rest of the region.
The Arab Spring was as much as anything an uprising for economic freedom, not just political freedom. It began with that self-immolation of the street vendor in Tunisia, Mohamed Bouazizi, mm-hmm. who wasn't protesting dictatorship in the abstract. He was protesting excessive taxation and red tape. Do you see the Arab Spring as having launched an economic revolution?
Well, maybe revolution is a strong word, but definitely economic change for the better. Because even, you know, as far as like Egypt is concerned, even in Egypt, before the Mubarak government was overthrown, even then we were beginning to see some signs of economic change in places like in Egypt. In places such as Saudi Arabia, we are seeing some sort of economic liberalization take place as well. So I think there is a general recognition that if you have so many unemployed people in your country, that is a recipe for trouble. And to get them jobs, you need to get the economy in better shape. So in general, I would say the economic picture in the region is improving, but it's starting from such a bad base that the improvement still looks small relative to the kind of problems they have.
The book is called Breakout Nations in Pursuit of the Next Economic Miracles. Ruchir Sharma is the author. He's the head of Emerging Market Equities and Global Macro at Morgan Stanley Investment Management. He manages about $25 billion in emerging market assets. Very interesting perspective on both the politics and the culture and the economics of so many countries around the world and how they relate to us. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. Enjoy it.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Have a great weekend, everybody. Talk to you Monday.